Hi listeners, we were joined at the SMSA by authors Rebecca Hazel and Ryan Butter to discuss Rebecca's journey writing the book The Schoolgirl, Her Teacher and His Wife. This discussion deals with some sensitive topics which some listeners may find difficult. There's a link to a description of the book in the accompanying text for those who are unsure. This event was held in the Henry Carmichael Theatre at the Sydney Mechanics School of Arts, which is on Gadigal land. This recording was made in front of a live audience.
Thank you, everybody, for coming out today in beautiful Sydney weather. It hasn't put too many of you off, which is great. And Rebecca, thank you for coming along and deciding to share your story and your book with us here today. I want to go jump straight in. I want to go back to the start. I'm always fascinated because writing a book is not easy. I think this took you over 10 years from... Something like that, maybe?
Well, probably over 10 years by the time it was added to several times, you know, with the court case kept dragging on and adding more.
So it's a long process to get a book out into the world. And so I'm really interested in the idea that sparks that, and I think in this case it was a conversation that you had with JC. So I want you to take us back there, the first time you heard this story and what grabbed you, what engaged you.
So I was working in a women's refuge at the time as a lawyer, and the refuge, you know, it was two houses. One was a fibro cottage and the one next door was a purpose-built accommodation for women and children fleeing violence. So we used to have our lunch together in the kitchen of the fibro cottage. It was very suburban, it was hidden. And so I really liked JC. She was funny and smart. And one day at lunch, I was talking about going to New York, and she said to me, "I love that place, nobody knows me there." And I thought, what does that mean? And so I kind of kept going back to her a little bit more and more. And she told me the dribs and drabs of the story, which was that Chris Dawson had been her teacher. He had groomed her, he killed his wife, and he moved her in.
Can I just interrupt just to say, maybe you can explain to the audience why we use the term JC and who JC was.
Sure. We use the term JC because there's been a court case. She was given those initials so that as a minor she wasn't identified, which is what they do with all minors in court cases. She can choose to identify herself, but she hasn't done that yet. So we call her JC even though her name had leaked out into the press before. As soon as the matter was in court, she was known by those initials.
And just for the people that haven't read your book or haven't followed the case, can you just give a quick outline of what happened involving JC, Lynn and Chris? That drib and drab story that came out, what was that story?
Yes, so the story was that JC was a schoolgirl when she was in year 10, so 15. Chris Dawson came to her school as a PE teacher. He'd seen her in the playground and he organised for her to be in his class the following year. And from that point on, he groomed her. They entered into... a sexual relationship. I don't really like that word because, you know, it was illegal what he was doing. Towards the end of year 11, and by the end of year 12, it was very messy. It was, you know, very messy. By that stage, Lynette knew. She had even moved into the house for a short period of time, and she told her to leave when she found out. So when she finished school, she said, "I'm done with this. You know, it's just too messy." And he realised that he was losing her unless he did something very drastic. So he killed Lynette. JC was camping with school friends finishing year 12 on the far north coast of New South Wales. He drove up there within 24 hours, 36 hours, picked her back and installed her in the house. So she continued to be... he's prisoner of sorts from school and now in the home.
In the book, you go through the documents of the coronial inquests. There were two coronial inquests on that. And reading it, it made me think of the Garcia Marquez book, Chronicle of a Death Foretold. The witnesses that saw what was happening to Lynette, there was abuse from Chris. The witnesses that saw that there was a relationship between a school teacher and a schoolgirl. And there's that saying, you know, it takes a village to raise a child. I think, does it take a village to stop a murder? Because I think reading Lynette's reaction to some of what was happening, she seemed incapable of taking herself out of that situation. And I'm just wondering, is this hindsight or could more have been done by the people around Lynette at the time?
It's a really difficult question because there was nothing that Lynette did wrong as such. He killed her. She was a victim. She didn't do anything that justified or made her, you know, become a murder victim. Can you hear me now? Is that better? Sorry. Yeah, so she did nothing wrong. He chose to kill her, so it was his behaviour that should have been modified. Having said that, there were people, particularly with JC and at school, teachers, students, her parents, lots of people knew, a few people said a few things, but no one did what needed to be done. And it was obvious that Lynette's life was really crumbling around her. But I don't think that anyone thought she was in danger of being killed. We know a lot more now about, you know, what the preliminary signs are for intimate partner violence and homicide.
And so then the second bit of that, my thought is, as I said, there was two coronial inquests. Both recommended that Chris Dawson be charged with murder, and neither recommendation was acted upon by the DPP. I wonder if you can, having looked at all the file notes, and I should say that Rebecca is a reformed lawyer, ex-lawyer, could you talk us through that? Did that, like, going back through the papers and knowing, again without hindsight, that those decisions, how did they come to that conclusion that they weren't going to proceed despite the coronial inquest recommending that charges be laid?
Yeah, it's difficult to answer that question as well, I'm sorry, because when a matter is referred from the coroner to the DPP, the Director of Public Prosecutions, the decision to prosecute is now completely in their hands, and they don't give reasons when they choose or decline to proceed. There have been things said verbally over the years that have kind of leaked out that somebody said that they had seen Lynette after she was murdered, and the DPP put a lot of weight on that, but they didn't discuss that with the family to understand how erroneous that was, or the police. I think you would have to say that there was misogyny as to how women were treated generally and before the law. I think there was no commitment to thinking she's a missing person. Two coroners think she's been murdered. It's going to be too hard, and it is too hard if you don't try. So that was very, very disappointing for the family.
But someone who did try was Damien, who's kind of like a silent hero in the book, I think, his character. Could you tell us a little bit about how you found him and your experience working with him and his story? Because I think that's also a really, really interesting story.
So when I began researching, Lynette Dawson's murder, Damien Loon's name kept coming up in articles. He was the investigating officer on the matter. It didn't go anywhere. You know, he got the two inquiry, the coronial inquests up, but as it didn't proceed.
What year did he get the case?
He took the case in 1998.
15 years.
That's right, after she disappeared. And from there it was 2001 before he could get a coronial inquest established. So after it was knocked back twice by the DPP, his superior said to him, well, you can't, we can't have you proceeding with this full time. you need to get on with other matters. So he said, can I do it in my spare time? And they said, okay. So he just kept going. You know, he just kept going. And when I read articles about him, he was at the Rocks police station, and I was, you know, trying to chase people and things, and I thought, well, I'll ring them and they might be able to say where he went next and I can follow him. I rang and they said, well, he's just out for lunch. Can we get him to ring you? So that was remarkable. I spoke to him and he said, yeah, come in. And I went in the next day. He didn't really ask me why I was doing it. I think it all made sense to him. And, yeah, he's just a champion. He just kept going and going and going. He was one of five children. Their dad walked out on them when he was very young. His mum raised five kids. He has three sisters, I think. He kept saying to me, if that happened to one of my sisters, this is what I would do. And it was that kind of personal quest and responsibility that he took that fired him up to keep going.
There were laws against stalking police officers, but apparently not. And then I want to go back to JC, because I think if you followed the podcast or you've heard the story, that's the Lynette Dawson case, but I think there's obviously another victim. Well, there's probably many victims, but there's another major victim in this, which is JC. And in the book, I was amazed at how willing she was to help you and to go back and visit places that would have, I assume, brought her great trauma to go back to. Can you talk a little bit about, without speaking for her, but you know, your relationship with her and her role in actually getting the book? And I know she played an important role in the final conviction as well with the testimony that she gave.
She did. It's a conundrum that I can't really explain as to why she happily went back to some you know, areas where terrible things had happened to her in her life. I mean, it's psychobabble. All I can think is that she tries to suppress a lot of that stuff to hold on to some good memories, because at other times we would be talking about what happened in those locations and we'd be really focusing on the nitty-gritty, and she would cry. She would cry a lot. I thought when I approached her that it was more likely than not that she would say, I can't cooperate with you, I'd like to, but I can't do it because she has so much trauma. But she immediately said, absolutely. I asked her why, and she said, because it's the right thing to do. And it's just so admirable for her. She'd been through two coronial inquests. Her sexual history with this man who groomed her and murdered his wife was on display. It was covered in the newspapers. It was just terrible. So I just have so much admiration for the fact that she did it, because she thought it was the right thing to do. She wanted people to understand that Lynette was murdered, and also what he did to her. I can't say he completely ruined her life, but almost ruined her life. Yeah.
When you started writing, did you start out going, okay, this guy's guilty, I'm going to write this book to prove this, or I'm going to give Lynette a voice or JC a voice? Or did you go in thinking, I just want to know what happened? What was the guiding motivation?
I think I thought he had killed her. I'd read enough about the story and the media coverage from the coronial inquest. I had a copy of the coronial transcript. I'd spoken to Damien, you know, many times. But I think I was still prepared to, you know, to think, well, there's always that doubt, you know, that he didn't do this, and all of this other information and events have been channeled towards that, you know, that end. So I tried to keep a really open mind, but it just kept driving back to the one conclusion that he had killed her. It did not make sense any other way.
And as a writer, you're exposing the truth of a murder, of a murderer. At any point did it cross your mind that you might be doing something dangerous?
No, like, never.
Was there any interaction with Chris Dawson? Did you ever approach the Dawsons? Because one of the bizarre things in the book, and it's a great read, it reads like a procedural crime, like a thriller. I don't know. It's, I don't want to glorify it, but it's very well written, and it drives through, the narrative drives really, really well done. But one of the interesting twists is that at the trial, or at the, I don't know if it's called a trial or coronial inquest, Chris Dawson's lawyer was his brother, Peter Dawson. I thought that was really interesting. But what was the interaction like with the Dawsons? Because they didn't, I mean, coming through the page, they, you know, the guy's a murderer. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I knew that they wouldn't speak to me because at that stage he'd got away with murder for, you know, 30-something years. Not 30-something years, a couple of decades when I started. But Peter Dawson, their brother, he's a solicitor and he did represent them, as you said, at the coronial inquest. So I wrote an email to him letting him know what I was doing, and it was only fair that, you know, they have their say. But he wrote back and dismissed what I was doing and said something like, you know, women decide to leave their husbands every day. There's nothing unusual here. It's like, well, they do, but most of them don't disappear and never heard of again. So, yes, and him being in the coronial inquest was just bizarre, really.
And then the other Dawson I want to touch on was Paul, who was Chris Dawson's twin brother, who was also implicated in the grooming that was going on at that high school. Where did he end up? How did his story finish up?
Well, they moved to Queensland, and at one of the coronial inquests, the second one, there was evidence led by some of the students who had been abused by Chris and by his brother Paul, who was also a PE teacher but a different school and on the Northern Beaches. And the Queensland government heard what was going on and they sent somebody down, and from that point they were suspended from teaching and from duties in the Queensland Education Department. He could see what was coming. So smartly he resigned and did something else. There's always been the hope that he would be charged because he really did abuse people and it was quite horrific what he did. But a lot of this depends on a complainant like JC being prepared to come forward and have their life dissected and picked over. And a lot of those women were mothers. Their children don't know. They don't want to burden them with that. So I don't know for sure, but I think that's why there hasn't been any proceedings against Paul.
Yeah. Yeah, you seem to get away with it in the book. Obviously, by the time you started writing the book to when you finished, Dawson's situation was...
But by the time you started writing the book to the time it finished, Chris Dawson's situation was very different. He was living freely at the time. He'd gotten away with murder. And by the end of the book, he was in jail. How did that change your motivation or your writing? Because you start off trying to prove or trying to give this voice, but then at the end it's done. Did you feel at any point, well, what's happened and the outcome you wanted has been achieved? Should I continue writing? Or how did the real life events as it went along with the writing? Because usually when you're writing, things are done and dusted. You're kind of writing in real time. And I'm just wondering how the events affected the writing and your motivation as a writer.
Yeah. I never thought I could solve the crime. You know, Damien hadn't managed to do it, in all that time. So my intention when I began really was to honour Lynette, let people know what happened to her, to honour JC, and also to, you know, to bring to light all the victims of a homicide. It's not just the person. I mean, primarily it's the person who's been killed, but, you know, she had two young children. She's got a large family, friends. JC went on and had a child, actually, with Chris Dawson. She's got siblings. Everyone wanted her to get on with her life, you know, just forget about it. And as she says, how can I forget about it? It's my life. So when I began writing, and as I wrote it, it was It was about honouring and explaining the damage that's wrought on society and individuals when someone's murdered. When I'd finished the book, Hedley Thomas, the journalist, got in touch with me. He knew I'd written this book, and he said, "I'm going to make a podcast about Lynette's disappearance. Would you be involved?" And anyway, long story short, I said, "Sure." So Hedley and I started out making a podcast about Lynette's disappearance. As that went on, it snowballed. People came out of the woodwork. I think they recognised that this was possibly the last time there was an opportunity to nail Chris Dawson for murder. And then he was charged. So, I mean, that was never, ever, ever in my contemplation. I thought he was never going to be charged, ever found guilty. So then it became quite odd. He was charged. And then as things went along, it turned out that the police wanted Hedley and I to be witnesses in the trials. So I went from writing quite a different story to giving evidence in a trial. And I was right inside it then. So it was difficult to write the second half of the book because I couldn't approach it with the same objectivity that I did, you know, the main part of the book. So it was very difficult, but it's a wonderful outcome. I mean, sometimes I'm with Hedley and we'll just pinch ourselves. I said to my husband driving home somewhere the other day, sometimes I think about, you know, Greg, Lynette's brother, and then I think about Lynette, and then I think about Chris Dawson being in jail, and it really is quite shocking that it's really happened and that's where he is.
Yeah, and the other thing was that it took, I think he was charged in 2018, but it was another 4 years before he was sentenced, so it's quite a long, long drawn-out process. I understand you had to stop the publication during that time.
Yeah, that's right. So the book was due to be published when just the exact time that he was charged with murder. So as soon as that was done, the book has to be pulled. The law of just sub judice says that you can't publish material like that. Once a matter's before the court, you can do journalist reporting, you know, the basic facts, what happened in court. So I just had to wait and think about, well, I'm going to have to add to the book probably, but there was a pandemic. The first time he ever appeared in court was by video link during the pandemic. So yeah, it just seemed to go on and on and on and on. And finally there was a resolution, but it was, you just couldn't have predicted any of it.
Yeah, one of the interesting bits I found when you became embroiled in the case, because you were probably one of the few people along with Damien who were following it for so long and so closely, as a fellow writer, it sent shivers down my spine, because writing, it's something you sort of do by yourself and you're in the dark and you work on your manuscript until publication day, and then the day before publication day you're very, very nervous because you're going to put this thing out into the world. You didn't get that. You had your notes and manuscript subpoenaed for the court. Can you talk us through what that felt like, and as a writer, and what your fears around that were? Because reading it in the book, it's like, oh no, that'd be the worst nightmare.
Yeah, I mean, it was a shock when the police turned up at my house. I can tell you that, not long after he was charged, and said, you know, we want all of the material and the copies of the manuscript you've written. Of course, I didn't have a problem with that. But as time went by and the police got all those documents, and then the defence, of course, can get a copy of all those documents. You know, Chris Dawson was reading them, his brother was reading them, everyone was reading them, you know, police, solicitors. It felt really, really awful, really awful that, you know, notes that I was making, scratchy notes, questions about myself were being pored over. And for the most part, I thought, why are they doing this? You know, it's just, I'm so insignificant in this story. And really I was. I mean, I did get called to give evidence, but it was a terrible, terrible feeling. And then when, you know, surprise, surprise, Hedley and I were called to give evidence, that made it even more difficult because I thought I'm going to be questioned on my own material, my notes, you know, half-form notes that you take when you're interviewing someone. Yeah, it was very, very unnerving, and at times I just thought I can't go on with this. It's just getting worse and worse. Yeah. And it gave me a sense, I have to say, of how Josie, a tiny sense of how she must have felt over all the years to have her very personal life, you know, plastered across the newspapers. And, yeah, I mean, it's hard to imagine how awful that would be for her.
Yeah, to be exposed and examined for something that happened when you were, I think she was 15, and she had a pretty difficult home life, abusive parents, it seemed as well, to then to have that dragged out and have to go over it in detail, trying to be caught out,
yeah,
in consistency.
Yes, that's right. And people did question her involvement. You know, I think a lot of people thought, oh, she's done this with him, forgetting that when they saw her as an adult woman, she wasn't that when he groomed her. She was 15. So I think it was really important for her reputation to be restored as well, because she was nothing but a victim as well.
Another hard question for you, so do your best. Coming in here today, I was thinking, oh, this, you know, this is quite topical. But then I thought, actually, we could have chosen any week in any of the years since this has happened, and it would have been topical because it happened so often, unfortunately. Through your time following it and going through and sort of in forensic detail seeing what happened, what could have been done differently, what could be done differently? Have any? I know we had a law change after this case about it was no body, no parole. Just from your view, just your personal view, what needs to change, what has changed? And, you know, if you had $925 million, where would you be spending it?
First of all, I'm not an expert in the area. I've looked at it, I've read about it, I have worked in it, but I'm not an expert. And it's trite to say if everyone knew how to stop it, we would have stopped it. So there are aspects we simply don't understand. It's very, very distressing that the homicide rate for women by intimate partners this year has been so high. You feel like we're going backwards. I think the only thing that's changed is that people are talking about it more. These homicides are recognised for what they are. They're just not thrown in with the general homicide numbers. So there has been slow change, there's slow understanding. But I think we've got a long way to go. I think, obviously, you know, the cultural change, particularly amongst men, about why they think this is an option to kill, you know, someone they're involved with or were involved with. But the law really has to step up here and punish these crimes. You know, if someone breaches an apprehended domestic violence order, they should be put in jail. A lot of these things just go unnoticed. They're not followed up. The police are improving that, so hopefully we'll just continue to see improvement. It'd be great if it could pick up, though.
One of the interesting things in the book was that nothing was done. She was assumed to have just walked off, even though I think it was 4 or 5 days later he'd moved his lover into the house. And the other fact was that her brother was a policeman as well. And I thought, how must he feel, or does he look back and... It just, there's so many victims in this, but it really did seem, okay, maybe you can't prevent what happened. He said she didn't do anything wrong and it happened, he's a murderer. But the follow-up seemed completely inadequate from many parts.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. He only reported Lynette as a missing person 6 weeks after she'd gone missing. Her family had tried to do it, but they wouldn't allow the family to make that report. It had to be... you know, your closest person, and for that it was her husband. And so he didn't do it. He only did it because her mother pestered him to do it. So 6 weeks later, we've already got a trail that's, you know, there would have been a lot more they could have determined if they got in quickly. Nonetheless, even at that point, at any time from that point on, if they tried to interview, if they come to the house, they would have seen JC living there. They might have interviewed her about what's going on. They might have interviewed all the other teachers, all the other students. All the evidence was there.
The credit card use seemed to be an important one to delaying that. The theory was that after she had disappeared, her credit card had been used at a local shopping centre. But there appeared to be no bank statement. There was no proof, and that was like something that really concrete that could have been followed up that was never followed up. I'm just wondering how much of it was police laziness, bad procedure, or just not caring, the misogyny.
I think it's all those things. You know, we didn't leave as many electronic footprints then. But again, if they'd spoken to Chris Dawson earlier, those records would have existed, you know, at her bank. The telephone calls that he claimed came from her could have been tracked, but that was all lost. And just sorry, answering something you mentioned before, which was that Lynette's brother Greg was a policeman at the time. He was, and he was really trying to do his best within a system that really doesn't like dissent. He was bullied a lot.
Yeah, that's why I raise it, because I think if he couldn't get the system to move, how would an outsider who's not a police person, how someone outside the system, how could you possibly get it to move in your favour?
No, that's right. No one investigated it properly at the time, and it's just such a travesty, you know. Because all the evidence, it really was there, had they done the work. It was there. There was no DNA evidence. There was nothing like that that got it over the line. It was people and their memories and what happened and timelines. There was just no other conclusion.
It seemed to be such a strong conclusion, and you had, I think for the podcast and for the book, high-profile people who you would normally think would sit on the fence would coming out. That you might want to talk us through that. I think the coroners that you spoke with, they were speaking to you.
Yeah, it was amazing. From the time I rang Damien and told him I'm writing a book, he just said, yeah, well, come in tomorrow or whatever it was. I rang the coroner. I think I actually sent him an email. I got his email address and said, you know, I'd like to talk to you. And I thought he would say, look, I can't, I'm a judicial officer. But he said, yeah, you know, come over, this is where I live. I do think it was just so much time had passed. So many people who had anything to do with the case and... That was in the podcast. Yeah, that was in the podcast, yeah. But they recognised this is their last chance, you know, to really see someone charged and convicted of Lynette's murder. So people were doing uncharacteristic things to try and get this across the line.
It's interesting, the true crime phenomenon. Do you think the police saw that, say, investigative journalism or... writing could achieve what they couldn't achieve? Was that why they were speaking with you? To try to get more people to come out, to raise the profile again, to put pressure back on to look at it? And should that be the role of writers?
Certainly Damien was hoping that, you know, what I was doing might encourage some people to come forward with more information. You know, when the book was published, again, more people would become aware of it, remember something that might have been critical. But Damien was really a lone voice, really, until the podcast. And, you know, until that was so successful, so many people were talking about the case, so many people were coming forward then. And then the police, I think, were embarrassed and thought we have to do something here. And that's not really good enough. I mean, I suppose it's good that they did something eventually, but they should have done that a long, long time ago.
Just want to jump out of the story a bit and go to the process of writing. I'm always intrigued how writers go about it. And going into the book, I hadn't listened to the podcast. I didn't really know anything about the case, just a few headlines I'd seen. And I knew that you were... a lawyer in a past life. it's going to be true crime. I'm thinking it's going to be kind of dry, procedural. It's not that at all. As I said earlier, it's a really fast-paced, like a great narrative drive through it. I almost felt, it was almost, I'm glad I've met you today, I felt like I was following like a Miss Marple type character going through collecting all these bits of information and putting the case together. But I didn't get any lawyerly input from your writing. Was that a considered approach, or that's just your style, is how you wrote, or you wanted to, because it could have been very dry, it could have been very factual, but it's a real human story.
Yeah, it's a really human story. I think when I started practicing law, I started off in a corporate role, doing corporate work, and I just really couldn't care enough, you know. So I switched to family law, and from family law I went into domestic violence work. And I thought what I was doing was important and it could really make a difference to some women and children's lives. And so when I began writing, I already had that kind of feeling that I wanted to make a difference. I was seeing the person, not the number. I guess that's why I ended up in the type of law that I did, is that I really connected with people and I wanted the law to work for them, to achieve really good outcomes for people. And I wanted to humanise the story as well. But I was very focused on JC and Lynette, that these two women had been silenced and this terrible thing had happened. So I was interested in the human aspect.
Yeah, it really comes across and you've done that very well. And the other thing that aids that is the structure. And I think you're dealing with piles and piles of documents that you've gone through in your research, legal documents. You must have done hundreds of hours of interviews with people. How did you settle upon the structure? Because what I liked about the structure, you do a lot of the evidence through the coronial inquest, but you also introduce the characters that are speaking, so it's not just a dry document, this is the testimony they gave. We know the people, and even little characters, and you kind of get a feel for them. And I think Barbara, who worked at the refuge, and how did you settle upon a structure, and did that evolve, or you go, this is how it's going to be?
Yeah, no, it definitely evolved. I think it was, I don't know, maybe the second or third draft that I really saw that I could use the coronial inquest transcript as the spine, and then from that talk about the evidence and then the people that I met, the things they told me. Because the time shifts were so big, you know, back and forth and back and forth. Once I kind of settled on that, it was much easier to tell the story, but it was critical to get that structure.
The structure works really well and it flows through because it's such a big time. You're talking about something that happened in the early 80s and then you're talking about what's going on in the coronial inquest, really
2003.
So you had all these different time zone time frames you had to jump in and out of. Now you touched on it earlier, the podcast. So you're there, you're writing away your book, and then you get approached to participate in this podcast. I'm interested, which then blew up and it was quite successful. What was that experience like? Again, writing, you're just doing your own thing, and then all of a sudden it's on everyone's lips around the country, what you're working on for the last 10 years. How was that experience? One, collaborating, because not many writers are collaborating during the process, but also in a different medium, and then having to share what sort of your story for so long with somebody else. How was that experience?
I think I'd finished the book by the time Hedley knew that I was writing this book. I'd rung him because he'd written an article around one of the coronial inquests, so I had rung him as part of my research. He knew I was writing this book. So when he decided that he wanted to do a podcast, you know, he said, the first person I rang was you. So I guess it was easier in that sense. So I wrote the story on my own. The podcast came later. And then that was a big story as well. So I had to add that. It was really odd because I'm not a journalist, you know, and you know, sometimes with Hedley, we felt that he was the journo with those skills and I was bringing the heart of people to the story. So there was a complementary set of skills, but it certainly was never in my contemplation to... I mean, I just couldn't have foreseen that at all. I hoped that the book would come out really close to the podcast, and I wish it could have come out in some ways before he was charged. But anyway, that's not what happened, so I just had to add to it that the writing of the book from the podcast and the trial and on, that was very strange. That was very, very strange because...
In what way?
Well, I think as you said before, you know, you write. I mean, I was interviewing people, but for the most part, you're back in your room at your desk and you're writing and writing and writing. It's a private process that you hope one day will be put between the covers of the book and people will then read it in the privacy of their own home. So to have that, that was the activity that I wanted to do. You know, it appealed to me doing that and working over words and expression and getting people's emotions right. So to then be in a podcast, it was just highly, highly unusual. I still look back and I just think, how did all this happen, you know?
What do you put the... Do you have a view on what's the fascination with true crime and why this particular case got that level of attention? Because it, sadly, it's all too frequent.
There is a fascination with true crime, and part of it worries me a little bit that we commodify it a bit too much. And I was, you know, trying to not commodify Lynette and JC through the book. I was trying to humanise them. So that worries me a little bit, and I think that there has become a drive in some cases for podcasts and true crime books and podcasts to try and drive it to a conviction, but often not. Often it's just prurient. It really is just fodder. And in this particular case, Headley had said as it went along, I mean, he was absolutely shocked by the number of people who were, you know, ringing in with more stories and more aspects. And interestingly, he said, if I had been writing this in the newspaper, nobody would have come forward. But it was such an intimate medium. People were listening to his voice. They were hearing other people, probably people they knew, people they went to school with. And that gave people confidence to think, oh, well, he's saying it. Maybe I should say what I know as well. And so the medium was very, very critical in getting this result.
It seems a lot more interactive than either a book or in live time. You can respond and do another episode depending on what comes in. But, of course, like writing true crime, as we've touched on, it's real people. Lynette's family is still here. JC still lives with us every day. What are the ethics around writing true crime and how did you navigate that minefield and the relationships with the family particularly?
Yeah, I was always really respectful of the people I spoke to. Sometimes I felt I shouldn't be speaking to them. Particularly the family, Lynette's family, who I went back to and back to and back to, and they participated with me for the most part because they thought a book would be great to honour Lynn. And like Damien, they were hoping that maybe someone else would come forward and there may yet be charges. But it was... I was constantly questioning the morality of what I was doing and... Was my purpose really good enough to be asking people to tell these stories and what they knew that were very upsetting? And so I just hoped that, you know, because you don't know you're going to get published. That's the other thing, you know. You're telling people this is what I want to do, but publication's no certainty. I found it hard at times, you know. But actually, Lynette's family, to be fair, there were times when I would be with them and I'd go to say something and I'd pull back because I thought, I can't possibly ask them that. And they would always say, no, ask us, you know, ask us. So their bravery was quite extraordinary, you know.
Had her mother passed away before you... Did you get to meet her mother, or she'd passed away before you started?
No, both mum and dad passed away just before the first coronial inquest, so they never had any knowledge of... They suspected, of course, that he had killed her, but...
It was quite a poignant moment when they talk about the diary that her mother had kept, and was also a crucial bit of evidence.
Yeah, the diary was amazing, and it was quite delightful that it was such a critical piece of evidence, because, you know, her mother, Lynette's mother, who just loved her so much and used to wander around the northern beaches and up and down New South Wales, where Chris said he was getting telephone calls just looking for her daughter, who she just adored and died without any resolution. But the diaries that she kept, you know, what Chris Dawson told her on day one, what he told her in the telephone call on day 3, 7, 14, 3 months down, it was really powerful contemporary evidence at the trial.
You know, when you're writing a book, you're carrying around that story in your head, whether you're writing fiction or history, you're carrying it around, you're thinking about it. I'm sure there are times when your husband caught you and you're off somewhere else and you're thinking about it. What's been the personal toll for you to get this story out? Because it's a long time to hold that, and it's not, you know, it's not a fun story, it's a tragic story, it's a traumatic story. What's been the personal toll for you to get this and get the story out? Because I know that comes at a cost.
Yeah, it was a very, very difficult road, especially those last years since the book was pulled just when he was charged, and then, you know, the trial. That was really difficult, and it was really difficult for my family. My husband's here today, and all I can do is apologise. Because it was really, really difficult. So there was a big cost, and there were points during the trial I just thought, I just don't think I can go through with this book. You know, it's bad enough being called in to give evidence, but then I need to write about it. So it was a very, very high price, personally. But ultimately, because he was found guilty and is in jail, it was, I'd have to say it's worth it, you know, me going through the trial and all that stuff, because it's just a great outcome. It's the right outcome.
As a reader, definitely worth it, and it's not sensationalist. It's just a really, it's a really human story. I think it's an important story. As I said, topical, but it's always topical. So hopefully people can read it and engage with it, and see if we can start to see changes as well. I've got one more question, and then I'm going to throw it open to the audience questions, so you can start formulating questions of what you're thinking. What's next for Rebecca Hazel? Are you going back to the law, back to writing? Does your husband have an opinion on that? Has he got another book in him?
I don't know. Well, I decided, do you know, when it was all said and done, Hedley rang me and said, I think I'm going to do another podcast about a woman who's missing. He said, why don't you come and write the book with me? And I said, are you nuts? Why would I go through all that again? I couldn't imagine anything worse at this point. So, yeah, I'm writing historical fiction at the moment. I really love literary non-fiction. I love it. So I'd like to think I'd go back to it. But I just need a break from it at the moment, and I'm enjoying writing fiction.
Very much, and thank you for sharing the story behind it, because I imagine as well, you know, it must be, some moments must be quite difficult to go back over, so I really appreciate you being so open and sharing with us here today. I'm going to throw it open to the floor if we have any questions.
I think Rebecca answered most of the difficult questions that you asked, which was great. This is might seem like a silly one, but you talked about the process when your manuscripts were subpoenaed for the court case, and even notes, and then mention of Lynette's mother's diary. So did you not have those documents when you were were in the trial? Like, or do you have copies of everything? How does it actually work when you have all that subpoenaed, you take copies before you hand them over?
No, well, what happens is that the police take copies of everything. Yeah, they have my original documents and then they take all the copies. Yeah, so that's how it works. I can refresh my memory before going to court on, you know, what I might have written. And they ask me questions about some of my handwritten documents and some parts of the manuscript as well.
Oh, hello, and thank you so much for your presentation this afternoon and for the, you know, very insightful answers to these great questions. One thing that occurred to me, and I haven't listened to the podcast, I actually chose not to because I thought I would find it too distressing and not read the book. What intrigues me, and I don't know much about JC's family background, the fact that a young girl of 18 agrees surprised that JC's family, well, I don't know whether they endorsed it or were shocked by that, or their daughters, you know, how her life was, you know, taking place. And I don't know if you feel able to talk about JC's family, but I'm just very intrigued by her parents.
Well, I think her family, she had a very troubled family life, and that was one of the points of entry that Chris Dawson identified with her, as a lot of victims are identified that way. So he presented himself as, you know, someone she could talk to, an older person. Her parents were really not present. They separated when she was about 13 or 14. Her mother was an alcoholic. She was, even though she knew people were telling her that this was going on, she didn't really do anything. Her father had asked her in year 11, because he'd heard rumours, if she was involved with him, and she lied and said no. So when it came out that she was, he said, well, you lied to me, I don't want to talk to you again. That was his response. So no one was offering her an alternative. I think I mentioned before that in year 12, JC actually moved in with Chris Dawson and Lynette for a brief period because her mother had repartnered and he had assaulted her. And she went back to the house after she'd been to the police, and her mother said, well, you can come back and live here, but you have to live under Ray's rules. So she took his side, not her daughter. So she had nowhere to live. You know, she was a young person who had not had a good start in life. She was very much under the power of an older man, and she had no options.
I think what came across in the book was that a lot of the activity between herself and Chris, or Chris's activity towards her, was happening at the school. Like in open, it didn't seem to be hidden, or it seemed a lot of other teachers knew about it. It just seems unbelievable.
Yeah, it's really disturbing. So many people knew about it. Someone did go to the headmaster, and actually Chris and JC were called into the headmaster's office, and he put it to them. Someone said that you're involved with each other, and they said, no, we're not. And so that was the end of it. And despite everyone knowing that it was still going on, it was, yeah, it's just bizarre.
Rebecca, thank you. At what point in the passage of time did JC come to realise that Dawson had murdered Lynette, or did she never realise it?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. So when she moved in, they were married about a year and a half later, or not quite a year. Chris Dawson petitioned the family court to say that he had been abandoned by Lynette, and then their marriage was dissolved quite quickly, and he married JC. She became pregnant. She had a child. She was also now the mother to Lynette's two little girls who were left behind. They were 2 and 5 when she disappeared. So JC is married to this very domineering man. She has her own child pretty quickly. Once she has her own child, and she'd lived in the home for a while, so she had observed Lynette with those two little girls, and she knew how much she loved them and doted on them. And when she became a mother herself, she realised that Lynette would never leave those girls in the same way that she would never leave her daughter. And once that realisation hit her, it took another few years because she was scared. He was beginning to be violent with her. It's unlikely he would have killed her because then we had a serial killer on our hands, but she didn't know that. She was a young person. And again, she had nowhere to go. So she did realise that it was a slow dawning realisation, and then she was more focused on how do I extract myself. But having done that, she did go to the police within a few months to tell them what she knew. There was another missed opportunity. They started to investigate it and then they just dropped it. So, yeah.
I think the other interesting bit, when she left and then towards the end of it, towards now, in the book, at the end of the book, she feels that she lives with this guilt for having abandoned the two young girls. I think, wow, someone who's gone through so much and she saved herself, but she lives with that guilt of having abandoned Lynn's children.
It's very sad. It's really sad, yeah.
Any other questions?
I'm intrigued, Rebecca, about the... hello there. Thank you for that. I'm intrigued by the teachers and the principal. Did you ever get to speak to them and find out what on earth were they thinking to ignore it?
Spoke to the principal really briefly, and all he kept saying was, my hands were tied, my hands were tied, and it really wasn't clear why his hands were tied. I just think he couldn't be bothered doing anything, you know. And so that was his excuse all those years down the line. He died very soon after I spoke to him. You know, he was lucky in a way. Maybe he would have been called to give evidence at the trial and he would have been deeply embarrassed.
Am I right in remembering that JC brought a case against the education department and lost?
Well, she wrote to the education department after she had left Chris several years later. So maybe she was like in her late 20s then and... she said, this is what happened to me when I was at school and I'd like to see my file and I'd like to see his file. And they basically wrote back and said, well, there's nothing we can do for you. But following his conviction and then also the sexual assault, he was convicted of that. And you might have read recently in the... press, she did bring in action against the education department. They tried to defend it initially by saying that she had been a participant, so there was no guy trial. There was nothing to answer for. 15. Just 15. Fortunately, I think they realised that that was a pretty untenable position, and then I think they settled pretty quickly after that. So. I don't know what amount of money she would have got, but her life has been deeply affected, her earning capacity deeply affected. So, yeah, no, that's right.
Thanks, Rebecca. Really brilliant. I've kind of got an impression, not specifically from you, but that there was a lack of police intensity. And almost a Northern Beaches misogyny kind of approach that it's particularly in that era, like that's what boys do, that's what kind of they get away with, and we'll quickly drop that investigation. And even Damien, who I have met in the past, struggled to make any headway at all, and yet he was a very top-level cop. Do you have any views on that?
So, if I understand you correctly, I don't think that the Northern Beaches was especially bad in that regard. It's the Northern Beaches has had the lid blown off it because of Chris Dawson and because of the podcast. I spoke to people in the course of doing my research. I'll never forget one guy in particular. He was a teacher. He'd come from overseas and he was teaching south of Sydney. And this would have been the mid-70s. And he was on playground duty. And one of these fellow teachers said, "I'm seeing that girl." He pointed to this young girl in the playground. And he told me that he said to this teacher, "Oh, man, you're really lucky. She's gorgeous." And so I think there was an attitude that these were victimless crimes, you know, that it was open slather, which isn't entirely true, obviously. That's, I mean, there were good teachers, we can't say that. But it was tolerated, I think, yeah.
One thing we haven't touched on today, you do in the book, is that Chris Dawson had a pretty high profile, I suppose. He was, I don't know, famous, but he played for the Newtown Jets Rugby League Club, had a rugby union career. Did that play a part in it, in that Northern Beaches thing? He was a known person. He was.
Yeah, I think it absolutely did. So when he reported Lynette missing, that was at Mona Vale on the Northern Beaches, not far from when they lived. And the police just kind of said, "Oh, mate, that's bad, but lucky you've got someone new in your life." And, you know, people forgive celebrities a lot. They think that they're entitled to things that the rest of us aren't. So unfortunately, I do think there was, and because he was a rugby player as well, I think if he'd been an actor, for example, maybe not so much, but a lot of policemen were quite in awe of him physically, his prowess and abilities.
Any other questions? Yes, I'm just wondering to what extent you think the absence of a body impacted on the prosecutor's decision not to proceed to trial.
Yeah, I really mull over that one because there are other situations where there is no body. A lot of murder trials are circumstantial as well. You know, someone can be killed and you might think it's an open and shut case, but the evidence can be twisted and it's often the surrounding events, you know, that tell the story of how that person actually died. And again, the evidence of her absence and what we know about her, and she had small children, she had deep connections. It's a story, and ultimately it did get up, and it still could have been told, that story, back then, but there was no commitment to really tell it, to really find out about it.
Mm. I don't have the statistic, maybe you do, but there's a really interesting bit in the book where you talk about the statistics of people that go missing, certain percentage of women, less percentage of married women, and then a tiny fraction of women with children. Yeah. They just don't go missing.
Absolutely tiny. And, you know, at the inquest as well, the coroner said, you know, a lot of people go missing and then most of them are found within 12 months and then it keeps whittling away. And of those people who are long-term missing, they're all victims of homicide. Peter Dawson tried to suggest that Lynette could have left and killed herself. But as Carl said, it's pretty hard to dispose of your own body if you've just killed yourself. So you really have to ask the questions, you know, where's the body? And if it's not there, why isn't it there? Mm.
Are you aware of changes being made within the police force about educating the police at the on the ground and also in the higher levels of organising investigation cases?
Look, I don't know anything. I know nothing in particular except for what, you know, we're all reading in the press. Yeah, I'm just not part of that at all. Yeah.
Do you have any other questions?
Hi, Hi. I just wanted to know how JC got away from Chris, and was she afraid for her life when she left him?
She was afraid. She thought about leaving for a long time, and she was too scared. She wasn't working. He wouldn't tolerate that either. So she was at home with all these small children, and they'd moved to Queensland by then, and they were living in a slightly isolated, semi-rural area. He controlled the money. He gave her a small amount of money each week that was to buy food. So all those things you think of that you might do or need when you leave, she had none of those tools at her disposal. She didn't have a car. She didn't even have friends up there, really. She had no one to help her. So it took a few years for her to say to him, you know, I want to leave. They went to counselling. And in the end, he just said to her, if you want to go, just go and do it quickly. But then, so she did. She came back to Sydney. And then there was a big fight about their child and, you know, all that stuff dragged it out. But she was scared. She was scared. And I think, you know, I can say now in the same way that I wasn't scared. My father was a little bit scared that he might hurt me while I was researching this. But if you've got away with killing someone for that long, you're not going to kill somebody else. It will only draw attention to the former. So, it took a few years for her to walk away, yeah.
Thank you, Rebecca, for a very interesting discussion, and you too. But I'm thinking of JC. You were involved, you know, you got to know her, you know what sort of person she is. What's your outlook on her future now? Is it something that's going to be optimistic for her, or will she be forever labelled, you know, the teacher's pet?
I guess I think the outlook for her is both of those things, but I hope for her she can have the satisfaction of knowing that he's in jail, you know, he did this terrible thing that she's lived with. You know, she would say she was killed because of me. And again, I would say to her, no, you had nothing to do with her being killed, you didn't kill her. So she carries that burden. But I really hope that her life will be less burdened by those things from now, yes. Mm. Yeah, and grandchildren, yeah. Mm.
I think we have to wrap up there. Thanks everyone for the great questions, great answers. And just to remind everyone that we do have the lovely people from Abby's Bookshop here if you'd like to grab a coffee, and I'm sure that Rebecca would like to do a bit more writing in them, sign some for you if you would like that. But thank you very much. Thank you, SMSA, for having us.